Welcome to the Beekeeper's Corner Podcast.
April 10th, 2016, episode 93, Rojo, an interview with J. David Waldman. Hi, everyone, and welcome to this edition of the Beekeeper's Corner Podcast. For this episode, we're going to step away from the traditional format and bring you an interview with a local beekeeper, J. David Waldman from Hopewell, New Jersey. I haven't done an interview format episode for quite a while. In fact, you have to go back to episode number 71 in the interview I did with Stan Wazatowski for the last one. Like that episode, this interview has been in the making for a long time now. I met David at one of our beekeeper meetings. He appeared on the scene and was instantly recognizable for someone who was going to take a measured approach to beekeeping. And quite frankly, he asked so many interesting questions. I and others took him through his set of inquiries, watched him get started, and followed his progress. And at one point, I pulled him aside and asked him if he'd be willing someday to circle back and tell us of his experiences. And that's what you're going to hear today. We tried on a few attempts to plan the sit-down and had a few misses, but we were able to finally connect today, and I think you're really going to enjoy listening to what he had to say. I think it's really good timing, as I would expect that a lot of beekeepers are about to embark on their first year journey, and here you can hear the day in the life from a viewpoint from someone who just went through his first year, but took measures along the way and can recount his experiences, victories, trials, and tribulations. Even if you're a seasoned beekeeper, it's interesting to listen through how he got through his first year. I'd like to get you to the interview, so I'll stop right here and we'll jump right into the discussion. I'll be back after it's done to share some parting thoughts, but one more thing before I go. I brought a video camera along, and if you prefer to watch the interview, please feel free to visit our YouTube channel, youtube.com/NWNJBA. You'll simply see us talking, but at times you'll be able to see David's hand gestures and expressions as we explored his first year in beekeeping. We shot that video, and I took this audio that we recorded and dubbed it over the video part. I should share that the video gets out of sync sometimes, but it was a better production with the dubbed audio than it was to listen to the native audio that the camera captured, because it really picked up a lot of the ambiance in the room, and it wasn't good stuff. There was a lot of coffee-making noises and people shoving chairs and children crying and things like that. So it drowned out the discussion, so to speak. So if you see the audio and the video a little out of sync, I kept tweaking it as I went through, but I think it's watchable, and maybe you want to watch it that way, consume this that way. Okay, enough on that. Please enjoy this sit-down with David Waldman. So, David, how are you doing today?
I'm good. Thank you, Kevin.
I am really excited to get a chance to interview you.
Myself,
This has been a conversation in months, I think, terms. When you and I met, I had mentioned to you that I wanted to do this, and I'm really, really happy that we're going to get the chance to talk here. So
I'm delighted. We're both busy, so thank you.
Do you want to try this, too?
I'm sure.
An extra cup.
Why not?
Thank you. Sorry. This is totally unplanned.
No, that's okay. And so that's a good opening, Dave. Where are we?
At one of our shops. This is Rojo's Roastery in Lambertville.
Yeah.
We're in our 11th year. It's a coffee roastery and a cafe.
Nice.
And that was Matt serving us some really unusual, what promises to be unusual coffee that a customer brought us back from Colombia a couple days ago.
Oh, very nice.
So the other part of my life when I'm not playing with bees is playing with coffee.
and I know you were just telling us at our last meeting that you just came back from a trip. You were overseas.
I did two trips back to back, one in Ethiopia for coffee exploration to try to find some new small independent extremely high quality farms. We're always looking for better and better. And then a USAID project as a diplomat of one of seven coffee professionals appointed by the U.S. Ambassador Derek Mitchell to Myanmar, Burma. Now that Myanmar promises to be democratic, with Aung San Suu Kyi implementing the democracy as we speak, we were given diplomatic freedom, unprecedented, to go to some of the remote northern parts of the country and work with farmers to improve the coffee quality. I have a certified palate for coffee, which would translate into higher export and export dollars, something that would be a totally new undertaking for Burma, for Myanmar.
Yeah, very similar to the conversations, you know, I had Tim Schuler on the podcast talking about
Malawi
and helping them improve their beekeeping practices there. And,
same idea, yeah.
So the reason I wanted to talk to you was that you're a first-year beekeeper.
I am.
Your first year under your belt.
And I'm happy to say, using Tim Schuler's words, rather than a bee haver, I'm a beekeeper.
A beekeeper, yeah.
I mean, literally our two hives overwintered successfully.
That's awesome.
I'm sorry, I interrupted. Yeah.
No, that's okay. No,
it's
look,
exciting.
This is going to be a great dialogue because I have so much to talk to you about. What piqued my interest to talk to you was that I knew right out of the gate, one, you're passionate about all the things that you do, and two, you had an unorthodox thought and style and research and whatever on how you wanted to approach that. And we're going to explore that in this conversation. But first, as a new beekeeper, where did you get started? How did you learn? Where did you find the catalogs, buy your equipment?
Yeah.
Take me through the absolute beginning of, I'm going to be a beekeeper, what do I do first?
Yeah. It's a funny story. My wife, Jeannie, and I have been married for 38 years. And a birthday present she bought me way back when was a correspondence course from Penn State on beekeeping.
Oh, I didn't even know they had those.
Yeah. It was, I think Penn State is still pretty front and forward on bee technology. I filed it away and never found the time to do it, but always had in the back of my mind that I wanted to beekeep. So I went onto the Rutgers website after talking to some locals in Hopewell Borough, where we live, where there actually are probably six or eight beekeepers, some of them backyards, some of them more in the township on farms. And they mentioned and recommended strongly that I take the introductory beekeeping course that at the time, it winds up it was the last year they did it, was Bob Hughes and Tim Schuler, the state apiarist, teaching. It was a 3 or 3.5 day course, hands-on with lots of handouts. And I tried to take the course 2 years ago. The class was sold out.
Yeah, it's tough to get into that.
It fills out. So then I got on the waiting list. This was April 2014, and I got so excited, I got a little bit ahead of myself and was calling around to try to get some bees, not realizing that everything's promised out, you know, from the December before.
Yeah.
So long story short, I waited out that year, signed up for the course in October, November at Rutgers, and in the meantime, to answer your question, I started digging pretty deep into the research, both on the internet and through WICWAS, which is one of the beekeeping
WICWAS press.
And Bee Culture and the bee magazines, and immediately started subscribing to both of them and trying to read them cover to cover.
Yeah.
As you said, and it's true, if I'm going to do something, I do it. I dig in and I jump in, and it's with passion and curiosity. So I basically, is it okay to mention brand names and stuff like that?
Sure, yeah, but I don't receive any sponsors, so I don't, you know, try not to disparage anybody, but by any means mention. I was going to ask you, whose stuff did you buy?
Yeah.
What equipment?
So long story short, I started building up a library and started reading voraciously. I have a background and an interest, my wife and I, in organic gardening, from our years in Nashville when I was a musician, which we can talk about later. And so I got a Michael Bush book. I got the Dayton book, the ABC book. I got some of the tomes for beekeeping. And then I started branching out. And then...
I picture you up late at night.
Oh, yeah. Nodding at it, the computer, doing research.
Yeah.
And one thing leading to another. And I've got notebooks. I take copious notes. And I'm never afraid to go to the thought leaders. My formula for how I like to do things is to do research, dig in deep, assimilate the knowledge, and then figure out who the thought leaders are and then contact them. They'll either have time for me or they won't.
Right.
So I started talking to Michael Bush. I started talking to Randy Oliver, who is probably, if I had to pick one single most important person that keeps my head straight, he's the guy. He's a prolific online publisher, and he does really thoughtful scientific stuff, but he has results that you can digest and act on.
Yep.
And then I started getting the Seeley book and the Winston book, and I started doing research on some of the older books that are out of print and started looking for them in used books. And before you know it, you got a library, you got magazines, your head is spinning, and you read about residual miticides in Foundation and commercial beekeepers over-medicating between with terramycin and with fumagillin and with all of the amitraz and whatever. And you read about the history of how that's led to resistance among the varroa mites. It really becomes, in a nutshell, a study of how are you going to deal with mites, which as recently as 2 months ago hit the last territory in the world, New Zealand, that was the only place left that didn't have. Now they're there. At the Rutgers course, which was amazing, they hand out catalogs from Brushy Mountain and Kelly and Better Bee. And I'm a catalog freak. I love looking at catalogs. So that was how I started learning about the equipment. And then as I...
When I was a kid, I remember the Sears catalog.
Yeah.
It was like Christmas when that thing came. What was I going to get?
I would
pick
flip
up the
through.
Racetracks
yeah.
and whatever. To me, when the bee catalogs arrive, it's the same thing.
Yeah.
I start looking through
it. It's like Steve Martin. You're too young, but like when the... Yeah. In the Steve Martin movie when the phone book comes out.
The phone book has come. I do remember that.
So I love when the new catalogs come out. So I educated myself, between the books and the catalogs. And then I started asking people around what quality you like. And then I joined your chapter, the Northwest chapter, and started going to meetings.
Yeah.
And started learning about the differences between manufacturers and the dimensional discrepancies.
Yeah, you came in right about the time we did the frame game, right?
Yeah, the frame game, exactly.
Yeah.
And then I started devouring all of the really rich information on the chapter website. And then I started buying stuff. I've got a modest cabinet shop in my basement at home. I was a cabinet maker professionally some years back and was hoping to use Cypress if I could because I wasn't fond of using paint. But as I found out, the Kelly are the people that make the Cypress ones, and their dimensions are not completely all square with the Brushy Mountain. And I tend to prefer the Brushy Mountain quality. I'm not afraid to pay a little bit more for better quality.
I use Brushy Mountain stuff too.
I just think it's good, solid stuff.
I don't know
stuff.
Why. I've just looked around and... You know, I think one day I just said, I need to center on somebody. I do like Kelly's stuff also. I like all of them, honestly, but for some reason it was just I picked Brushy Mountain. I went and looked at their website. That was another factor. It's like how easy to find the information.
Exactly. So to answer that question, probably 90% of what I use is Brushy Mountain. The exceptions are if I'm looking for a Cypress box, they don't offer them.
Yeah.
So I get them from Kelly. And then the other thing is my unorthodox initial approach. All the reading I did and the emails back and forth with people like Randy Oliver and Michael Bush and trying to sort through a predisposition of natural people to not want to treat, which I decided was unrealistic and probably impossible.
Yeah.
I tried to figure out what's the best approach to be practical and to do everything you could to ensure survival. And the theory and the observation that I developed after going to meetings and meeting other beekeepers in the area was that beekeeping is sort of a metaphor. It's like a lifestyle. You bring with you the way you are. If you're sloppy, if you're organized, if you're curious, if you're just tell me how to do it. I don't want to get too, you know. You take all that
You've
with you.
You've noticed that, have you?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And people bring that with them, and that becomes your framework for what kind of beekeeper you are. And I'm not
That's
making
a great
judgment
observation.
Calls.
You know what's funny? I've never... Yeah. I have that in the back of my mind, but as you articulated, it is so true, right? As the president of the Beekeepers Association, I meet people of all walks, and that's what made you stand out. You were there as a first-time beekeeper. You didn't even have bees, yet you asked the most important and interesting questions. Like, I don't want to use foundation. How do I get started? That was what I remember one of your questions, right?
And I was nervous about it because there aren't that many people around that do it. What I seem to observe was there tends to be localized practices, for example, here in New Jersey, where everybody's doing two deeps and everybody's doing either the plastic foundation or the wax foundation crimp wire.
Yep.
And there's a lot of followers and a lot of, you know, and I kind of felt like I have nothing to lose here. I'm not doing this for money. I'm doing it for fun and because I think pollination is important, which delights me to no end that Obama's pollination policy came out last year.
Yeah.
And that's having some positive effect. But in any event, everything I absorbed about residual miticides and cleanliness of wax led me to want to do foundationless, with all the caveats. If it's not straight, you'll get wonky cross comb.
Yes. That was a conversation I remember you and I having. Like, you know, you could try this. I'll replay the conversation, see if it rings a bell with you.
Sure.
You could try this. I'm all for it. It's fine. However, you're going to start with bees, and you're going to get to June. And if you have wonky comb and you have to get them started, it is really difficult during the dearth to get them to build straight comb in time for you to get to winter.
Yeah.
So I don't remember. I deal with so many beekeepers. Did you start with packages or nukes?
Nukes.
Nukes.
George Safer, nukes. Again, based on my reading, I was convinced that even though you'd wait another 3 to 4 weeks later on in the season, that there were significant justifiable benefits to waiting so you could get an integrated family, as opposed to having somebody weigh out a bunch of bees, dump a queen in a box, and it's like, oh, well, whatever. Like here, you have productive brood, you have developed comb, you've got anywhere from 3, 4, or 5 deep frames, depending on how they sell them.
He sells 5-frame nukes, right? So you had 5s?
I think they were 4.
Oh, yeah?
I'm trying to remember. I think they might have been 4s.
Okay.
And so I took delivery May 17th last year, after everybody sometime around the 10th or 15th of April had had their packages going. And I was going like, oh, my God, everybody's already like, I'm never going to get, this is never going to happen. And then you read all the myths and all the misinformation and the highly opinionated misinformation.
Yes, there's a lot of opinions out there.
Yeah. And it's a question of don't do foundationless because it takes too long. You're going to be behind the eight ball. Or put in a popsicle stick or don't put in a popsicle stick. Or, you know, paint it with wax. Or string it, or use bamboo skewers. You know, your head is spinning with everybody's opinion of the way to be successful in foundationless.
So stop for a second and tell us about your operation, right?
So my operation.
Tell me about your yard and your benches and your hives and how you set things up.
So in my typical way, where I do stuff, I kind of do stuff for the long haul, and I like quality, and I like this for whatever I do to have been thoughtful about what I'm trying to do. I'm not one to cut corners. So we have almost an acre lot right in the borough of Hopewell. We've been there 32 years.
Borough, like you're right in the middle of town.
We're
you
right
have
in
neighbors
town.
On both sides.
Yeah.
You're on a, a town street, basically.
We're surrounded by, it's a village designated town. It's just under 2,000 people, maybe 680 homes. And we're on a street with just house after house after house. So we had fencing that pre-existed. We had good southern exposure. We had a backyard that was set back from the neighbor, far away from any neighbor's houses, far away from the sidewalk of the back street, because our property backs on another street. We have two streets on our property.
Yeah.
So we didn't want to be close to the school kids, or we didn't want anybody to freak out if it was in their flight path. So we have good exposure. The fence was up to block the northern wind. I had done all my homework from the handouts from Tim Schuler's course. Read the best practices piece on municipal beekeeping in terms of let your neighbors know, give them a, you know, giving them a bottle of honey every year does wonders.
Yeah.
Talking to them about it, having it not be close to, you know, all the what I think is common sense ways to do it. I didn't tell my neighbors that I was doing it. I have one particular neighbor who I'm concerned about, who, if that person knew about it, they would have caused a stink, even though it might not have presented any kind of a nuisance whatsoever.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And she's someone who typically doesn't leave her house. She sits around a lot in the house. So my risk evaluation was, she's not even going to know I have bees because she's never out in the yard. She doesn't have a garden.
Yeah.
So on that basis, I didn't say it. On the basis of my other neighbors, they are so excited. I get notes and emails from them.
Nice.
Your bees are watering in our bird bath, and we're adding another bird bath because...
Wow, that's the kind of neighbor I want.
Yeah. So it's amazing.
That's great.
And I kept telling them, I said, we won't have any honey this year because you give them all the honey you make to overwinter them. But when we harvest next year, I can't wait to give you our local honey. And they're so excited. So in general, it's really nice. So I excavated down into the soil. I drove out a couple hours to a place in Pennsylvania that has cypress 4x4 posts because I didn't want to use any treated lumber of any kind for off-gassing purposes or for whatever toxins there might be. Then I dug the holes. I put in three stands, so it's four posts per stand, with a horizontal piece to put the colony on. And they're all facing south. Each one's a little bit different angle in case I need to do any equalization or if just to play with them. And it wound up that the box on the left was hive number one, the box on the right was hive number two, and I have a center box unused that's my prep area where I can stage whatever work I'm doing in either of the hives.
Like a little bench almost.
Yeah, it's a bench. And then I have benches on the side as well, but I use that as my staging bench for inspections or for adding something or for doing, you know, whatever needs to be done. And it's gravel, and we've got watering containers across the way, maybe 50 feet away, and they love it. They obviously find the water.
Yeah.
Our neighbor had a pool at the time, but they took the pool out. It was an above-ground pool. The kids are grown, so they decommissioned that. So the importance of water is really big.
Well, also,
now.
We shot a short video at your place.
Right.
I've seen your operation,
but
I wanted everybody to have a sense of what it was like. And you have a dog bowl with stones in it that you fill the water.
Exactly.
And I thought what was really neat is that you keep the water containers outside to fill that so that it's ambient temperature and you just pour it in and you have them on hand.
Exactly.
Yeah, and your borough is surrounded by the township, which is a little more open space. There's farms and forests and things
We're
like
surrounded
that.
So by
your flight
green
path.
Acres. Yeah, our flight path back to the St. Michael's or to the park. It's amazing.
Yeah, you have
there's very few people using green lawn chemicals. We're out of range of the flight path, 2.5 miles from any golf course.
Yeah.
So I don't worry too much. I've registered with an APS number, so if somebody's going to be doing something technically, they need to contact me. If they're going to spray any kind of pesticides.
Yeah.
But I feel like things are good in terms of foraging capability. There's tulip poplars, red maples.
Yeah.
There's everything you can imagine.
As I drive through Hopewell on the way home.
Yeah, yeah.
And as I look at the flowering trees right now, the borough is just beautiful. There are so people who have planted diverse trees on all the streets and so on, that there's an abundance of forage. And I don't think you have a lot of competition in there for, you know, there's not a high pressure of, there's not some commercial operator somewhere nearby and other things. So I think you're in a good, really good place.
I did a little bit of a census word of mouth during the winter and discovered that there's probably 8 keepers in beekeepers in Hopewell.
Yeah.
And sadly, most of them they keep by negligence, so to speak, or by abandonment. So they'll call me and say, I lost my hives. And I'll say, well, what did you do? Or can I come and look? And, you know, it's not a level of involvement. But I was talking to Tim Shuler the other day, looking at a neighbor's hives who I'm helping him maintain. He's got 4 hives at his farm in Hopewell. And what concerns me as a new beekeeper is the health of your hives are no better than the health of your neighbor's hives if they've got foul brood or if they've got mites or if they're coming in to do some robbing or absconding. And that's what happened. I think that's my concern, because none of my neighbors, we've got 2 on the street, like literally a block away, who don't do any treatment at all, and they've lost all their hives.
I have that in my neighborhood too. If you go within 3 square miles of my property, there's probably 10 beekeepers, and I know some of them lose their bees every year. And I don't know the answer to that other than, just, you know, when I see the people on the street, I try to offer guidance and help them out. But it is a frustration.
Lay your religion on them, and they've chosen to make it passive, and they're not, it's more of a hobby where they're not.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Tim had an interesting comment. He basically said that might be an opportunity for what's the acid that everybody's vaporizing now?
Oxalic.
Yeah, he said that might be an opportunity for oxalic. He said normally he's not a fan at the moment of oxalic acid because it doesn't get into brood.
Yeah.
But in the case of neighbors with bad practices coming into your hive, it'll get them.
Yeah.
So he was saying that might be an interesting application of oxalic acid fuming.
That's an interesting point.
Yeah, which I had not thought about. Yeah.
So you started your packages in May.
Started in mid-May. Got Kelly. The one thing I forgot to mention, a hardware item, is there's a wedged V-groove that I think you or Bob had
told
me about.
I think it's style F frame.
That's
in your
right.
Catalog.
And so I got a bunch of them and built them up. And that's what I use for foundationless. So
ask on those, did you just you use the top bar and the rails and the bottom?
Yep.
Full frame.
Yep.
You talked earlier, you could put bamboo and all these things.
Yeah, and I later experimented with that. Yeah. Later on in the year, when I started getting cross-combing and some stuff where I had to go, like, this is not salvageable, I'm going to cut it out and start again. But I was still determined to see how I would fare with foundationless. I did a couple things. I strung some of the hives. I replaced frames where I'd have 3 nylon, like fishing line monofilament horizontally. And then I did some with bamboo skewers going vertically. And I've had good success with both of those in terms of cross-combing.
They just build straight down through them, right?
Yeah. And it's not an issue. I can't speak for extraction because this will be the first summer when I extract, and we'll see if I wind up crush and strain.
Did you do those in your honey supers? You started with a nuke, which came with foundation, right?
Right.
Did you replace those frames, or did you leave them in there?
I left them in and supplemented them with foundationless deeps.
Okay.
And of the foundationless deeps that got wonky, I would replace them with ones with either the monofilament wire or the bamboo.
Yeah.
And the supers, in every case, were foundationless, without anything, because at that point they had started building and things were going pretty well. For some reason, the supers seemed to do better for verticality than the deeps. Maybe because there's more room
I think, or more real estate. I don't know. This is my speculation. But when they're building brood comb, they'll build brood comb in any way, shape, or form. But when they're building honey, they typically tend to build that a little bit straighter. But, you know, it's funny is I've been trying to go foundationless, and I have those same frames. What I had said to you, for those listening, is take your nuke, get it centered in the box, let the bees build out, put the outside frames, let them build them out, and then spread that nuke apart and be putting frames when the nectar flow is on in between them, so that you have a built frame, and an open frame, and they'll build less wonky in that way,
I think that's good advice.
I have brushy mountain frames, and I just put a whole bunch of them together last year and put them in my hives. This year I ordered all Kelly, but the full frame. I use those Kelly frames, the F frames, but just the top bar in my top bar. And this year what I'm doing is
literally
buying
no
full
sides
frame,
or anything?
No sides in my top
bar. Like a top bar,
Right? And this year what I'm doing is I want to switch to foundationless like you. So I'm curious about the rods versus the fishing wire or whatever you used, which one was better. I've heard Roger Garris, he talked about recently, he was at that last meeting where he talked about he put the dowel down through, and that worked out really well.
Yeah, I bought a box of bamboo skewers from like a restaurant supply and then drilled little holes in the top and bottom, cut the bamboo skewer with a pair of wire cutters, oversized, so you bend it in and then it straightens out inside the hole.
Does it go through the top and the bottom? And did you
glue
them?
No. I only drilled the holes partway through.
Oh, okay. I see. You put them in.
So like you'd have to force them in. Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah, I didn't want to have to deal with them falling out from drilling all the way through. So I drilled them maybe halfway in.
Oh, very interesting.
Yeah.
But did you have them? I bought the frames built, so I'm out of luck.
Yeah. I always build my frames myself. Yeah. So it's a lot easier to do that drilling unassembled, obviously. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm mining gold here. I'm trying to figure out how I'm going to do it, because this is what I have in store.
Well, you should come and look. I mean, I haven't fully opened everything up to see what's going on, but it'd be nice to figure out if the horizontal fishing monofilament does better than the bamboo.
Yeah, it would be interesting.
Yeah.
To
I suspect that's more a function, as you say, if you're alternating it with traditional stuff so they don't have too much room to go crazy.
Yeah.
Because if you have three foundationless in a row, this has happened to me, you get two of them that are one.
Yes.
And it's like a unibody where it's like, oh, my God,
yeah, they end up
useless.
Joining them in the middle.
Yeah.
They'll do it any way they want.
Yeah. So I have a serrated knife, and sometimes I'm
like
separate.
Like a big bread knife that you go down between
the two. And that's what I have to deal with.
I see a lot of times when you cut those apart, they come back and glue them back together.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're almost better just cut the whole thing out and put it back
and
in
start
there.
Again.
And at least it has wax on the beginning, and maybe they'll build it right the second time.
I agree. It's hard to write one that they've completely wonked out.
Yes.
And I'm not sure why. It might be because once they do it, that's their memory for how to do it.
Yeah, I don't know. I agree with you, though, that once it's crooked, it will always be crooked, and you're just better to cut bait and cut the thing out.
And just like in, I use a Imrie shim off-season, so I'm not crowding things to put in patties or fondant or whatever I'm doing. Yeah. And that's always the case that gets filled with all this burr. Just
they'll build burr comb.
They'll fill it because it's this extra space.
Yeah.
And they figure, like, we need to fill this with stuff. Yeah.
That's neat, isn't it, that they do that? I mean, it's universal that way.
And it happens unbelievably quickly.
So what kind of equipment did you buy?
So I bought Brushy Mountain.
Did you buy their bee suit or what?
No. I didn't buy any kits. I bought pretty much everything a la carte.
Yeah.
Because when you do the math, you don't necessarily get what you want in their kit. It might not be of the quality or the specs that you want. Or to save $2, it might not be worth it for
this,
you.
This goes back to what you said earlier. Some people just want to pay one price and get it all, and other people are, I don't need this thing, so I'm not buying the full kit that comes with wood chips and things like that.
Yeah, it's like, exactly.
So you're right. It's all in the eye of the beholder.
So for me, being a catalog maven like you are, I really a la carte everything like I wanted. So I found that I preferred a tool from another company, and so I wouldn't get their tool.
I think that's pretty common, that you might find one company that you have an affinity for, but I just bought a Nuke feeder. I was looking at the various ones. Brushy, which is, you know, again, the both of us.
Yeah.
They have a plastic one. I have no use for that. I'm not going to buy that, right?
Yeah.
I saw the one from Kelly, and I bought that one. And what I thought is I'd buy it and look at the design and see if I could make it on my own, because I, too, have a wood shop.
Right.
But after looking at the thing, it's beautiful. I'm like, I told my wife, I'm going to have to buy a couple of these.
Yeah.
Because I can't make it for what they sold it to me. It's got nice handholds. It's it's a craftsman design kind of thing almost.
And
right?
In a nutshell is what I like.
So you do look around and go, this one suits my need. We're very like in that manner.
So in taking that Rutgers course, Bob and Tim brought in all kinds of frames, all kinds of foundation, all kinds of feeders, all kinds of gadgets, the excluders and the reducers and the landing strips and the whatever. And they would give, and often they were at odds with each other, but they would give the pros and cons for what they liked and didn't like. And I took notes.
And Tim would always tell you, this is what it does, and some people use them, and I don't.
Yeah.
Because I, you know, it's too much trouble because I manage it. And Bob would always be, this is junk, you don't need this.
Right, you don't need this.
I bought a lot of things that Bob thought they were junk, and I, you know, like the frame hangers?
Yeah.
You have one of those,
remember. Yeah, I do.
I think that thing's invaluable.
Yeah.
Bob used it, no use for it.
Yeah, exactly.
So to each his own, I suppose, right?
Yeah. Exactly. So Brushy Mountain was the lion's share of the equipment in terms of boxes. And I went, they have maybe commercial, middle of the road, and select. I usually went for select. And then I painted them with a Benjamin Moore primer, an exterior primer. And then I got Cypress when I could from Kelly. Got a stainless steel mouse excluder with holes. I got some reducers, got some Emery shims, got screened bottom boards, which I have to date not deployed because I go back and forth and I've decided I don't think they're for me, even though some people rave about.
I've been switching them seasons.
Yeah.
And I think I'm this close to just saying I'm going to leave the solids in. And
yeah. I've only done solids.
I haven't figured that out yet.
Yeah. I've only done solids. And if you're committed to doing an alcohol wash, I'm not convinced that the sticky board approach to a screen is, it's probably not the best way to get a grip on your Varroa population anyway.
Yeah, I agree with you.
Yeah, so, and then I recently got some Nukes from Brushy Mountain. So I'm getting two more. So we're now going from two to four.
Four, yeah, double in your road.
And I have three stands, so I've got to excavate and add a fourth stand. I'll be doing that in the next 2 weeks. So they'll still be in line facing south with good exposure.
Are you going to do tackle splits this year, or are you going to buy
I just did one.
Nukes? You did?
I just
okay,
did.
Good.
After our last meeting, I have what I think are pretty strong surviving colonies, and one is significantly visually stronger than the other. So I took a chance not wanting to do too many things that, you know, you sort of want to calculate your risk. So I took the stronger of the two and I split it.
Yeah.
And after we spoke at the meeting, I now have three deeps on the stronger colony on the right.
Yep.
And I checkerboarded and I moved things around to preserve the dome.
Yeah.
And moved up some brood. So it's, you know, brood and honey and pollen and then I put in other frames. I moved up a couple frames with drawn comb, but I don't have the luxury, being my first year, to have a lot of that. So you put in foundation.
That's where you're at, right? Is you need to...
you got to build that
just
stuff.
Just keep building. It takes like 3 years to get built comb where you have access.
Yeah.
And
But just for the sake of the audience, I came to you for advice at the last meeting. I had 30 or 40 pounds of honey left. And my theory is that mild winters might be more challenging on bees than hard winters.
Yeah.
It's a little counterintuitive, but I'm developing a theory that that might be the case because of the confusion and because of the feeding, but not necessarily having enough warm days to go in and look for fear of chilling the brood, et cetera. Let me
tell you something Bob Kloss just said at our exec meeting, and I've heard him say this before too, is that he weighs his hives. He has a scale.
Right.
Every year, doesn't matter whether it's cold or hot in the wintertime, his scales drop the same amount, and he checked with John Gott, who also does instrumentation of his hives, and they're seeing the same thing, and people are thinking because it's warm, the bees are eating all their stuff. His assertion is that that's not true. They only eat a pound and a half. They've been dropping a pound, pound and a half each week until they get to like April 15th, and then they reverse and start to go back up. And the interesting thing about what he said is that he thinks 60 pounds is the right amount, right? The Merit Guide and other resources will tell you 60 pounds going into winter.
Right.
And he said, if you do the math, they'll eat through half of it, and then they tend to be comfortable with 30 pounds in reserve. When they get lower than that, they get a little antsy or a little nervous. So 60 pounds to him was the right number, and he's been weighing his hives for a couple of years now, and so is John, and they're both saying the same thing.
And you're saying coming out into April,
you think about from like just January to April 15th, they're dropping a pound, pound and a half every week. And then in April 15th, when the trees bloom and go crazy, then it just starts to reverse and they start putting on
weight.
Fascinating.
Because that's about what I had left in honey in both hives.
Yes, and that's what, I was brainwashed
by, oh, you're going to run out of food, you got to put in more honey. And my experience this first year was half of what I put in is reserve.
Well, he starts seeing also, and you have to take into consideration that you go from a winter cluster to a full-blown box full of bees. They're adding on bees, too, which also makes give weight. So usually sometime around the first week of April, I don't want to quote his, he showed us this last December when we did the meeting up in Belvedere's. He starts to show where they add on weight. And it's not the nectar flow, but it's the addition of bees and some nectar being out there with skunk cabbage and some of the early spring plants that are available. So it's pretty interesting finding. Chat with him next time.
Yeah, yeah. Because as you know, I've been working with you to do some research on monitoring systems. And I can't wait to put in my own monitoring system just so I can get a better grip of all this kind of stuff, because coming through the first winter, and albeit a relatively mild winter, you enter the black hole. You go like, oh God, I'm going to throw some fondant in. I'm going to tuck them in. I'm going to have a vent hole at the top and a feeding. And you go like, I don't know what the hell's going to happen.
And
I would love to have some, just because of the way
That's a great observation of a first year beekeeper is. You put them in fall.
You hold your breath.
You come out the other side and wait. And I know people who just are besides themselves fretting.
Yeah.
And by the way, it doesn't change. I stare out my window and look at my hives, and I just go, boy, I hope they're doing okay.
Yeah.
I mean, I occasionally walk outside and look at them, but
I walk out there almost every day, no matter what the weather, just to observe. I don't knock, I don't tap, I don't poke, I don't, you know. But just to sort of get a vibe for what's going on. It's really sunny today. Are there dead bodies accumulating, or is it pretty clean in there through the holes of the mouse excluder, et cetera? But, yeah, I feel like we're entering the black hole from the cold weather to the spring. It's like, I'd love to know more than that.
So what did you think of your summer experience, right? You got your bees established. They started to grow. I came over and talked to you about feeding at one point, I think.
Yeah. You came over at one point when I was concerned about, I mean, I didn't know the difference between an orientation flight and robbing.
Right.
So I kept going like, oh my God, I'm being robbed. It's like, no, we're hatching. This is brood hatching, and it's 2:30 in the afternoon, and there's some craziness out front because they're learning how to fly. They're 3 days old, whatever.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I've learned a lot.
You see that afternoon, vroom, and now they're all out and doing
yeah.
whatever.
Yeah, and they're doing it now, warm. The last couple.
Yes.
It's crazy.
Although this morning it was 27 degrees.
Yeah.
I'm waiting for next weekend when
next
we
weekend.
Do our, we have a B meeting coming up
right.
where we're
going
to install. Right. It's supposed to be 65 degrees. And finally, I think we're going to
next weekend. Is this at the Mentoring Hives?
Or? At the Mentoring Hives.
Do yeah. I know that? Maybe it's not in my book.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I'll be there.
Now you do.
Yeah. The 16th or something? Or
Yeah, the 16th is the date.
Oh, I do know that. I'm
and then
be,
the 23rd, the
yeah,
following
23rd,
is the
I know,
state
yeah.
meeting.
Yeah, the 16th, I'm going to be in Atlanta for
okay.
a coffee meeting. That's what it was.
Yeah.
Darn. I'm going to miss that.
We're going to use the jib and put up a swarm trap in that meeting.
Oh,
also.
Neat. That's another thing I wanted to do this year, but I'm not getting to it, is to put up, you know, you always, you see the warm weather coming and you go, oh man, they're going to swarm. What's my strategy for
yeah.
preempting swarming? You know, hang some stuff
you
in trees.
You hear us all talking about it, so now that's got to be swimming around
oh, yeah.
in the back of your mind.
Yeah, so I keep, every once in a while I'll call Jeannie and I'll say, you home? Can you take a look? Like, do we still have bees?
Yeah.
It's crazy, but whatever. So... Last year when you came over, we ran into some problems, and this was beekeeping 101. So the day, May 17th, the day I brought home two nukes and installed them from, well, he actually installed them. I brought empty deeps, and he installed
yeah.
them.
Did you go to his house?
I went to his house.
Yeah.
He and his father were there with boxes all over their lawn, and you had an appointment with a 15-minute window. And it was production. He was just knocking it out.
He has a large apiary right near me.
And, uh-huh.
Typically what he does is makes his splits right there in the apiary.
Yeah.
And then you drive by and every spring I look and there's 50 nukes running across the field. It's right about now when the mustards are coming out in
right.
the fields and stuff. And it's
yeah.
really neat. You know, and you think... I'll say this for the listeners. May seems an odd time, right? A lot of people want their bees back in April.
Yeah, yeah.
But he makes the splits, and then he leaves them out, and he's got them. He's, I don't know if he's feeding them or what he's doing, but they're on full forage, right?
Right.
And by the time you get them, they are bursting. They're
yeah,
bee
yeah,
bombs
yeah, yeah, yeah.
when you guys got
yeah,
them.
Yeah.
As I've seen George's nukes come
oh, they
out,
were incredibly
I've purchased
active.
Some in the past.
Yeah.
They're full. They're full. Five or four frames, whatever you're getting.
Yeah, yeah. And he might vary year by year. I think our year it was four. So I bring them home, set them into my apiary that I just described, and I'm sitting there all excited. And all of a sudden I see a Mark Queen dead being hauled out to the front landing.
Ooh.
And I'm going like, wait a minute. My idea of a nuke was that they're an integrated family, like Leave It to Beaver. Everybody's happy. One happy family. And like, they would have already rejected the queen. So anyway, I called him. I went back. We started all over again. So that was my first experience losing a queen the first day.
That's pretty unusual. And the fact that
yeah.
you saw it was even more unusual.
Yeah. It was. They literally hauled her right to the front. And I guess I was there at the right time before they ditched her or flew her off or
yeah.
whatever. And I was really clearly upset. And he said, oh, yeah, come on back. And he took care of it. And it made me wonder in retrospect, like, I guess everybody has different ways of doing nukes, and the queens are introduced in different ways and different times. And this did not comport with my understanding of what a nuke was in terms of having a pretty well-integrated queen with the family, because all of a sudden I get home after a car ride, and for whatever reason they decided they were going to kill the queen, and they killed her.
There's different ways to go about making a nuke, right? You
sure.
can pull the queen out that's marked and it does become the family, or you can pull the frames out and give it a queen, and depending on how
And he did the latter.
Yeah, depending on how
And that explains, I think, probably the rejection. Maybe.
I think it's a really small rejection rate when that happens, because
yeah.
if you're taking a laying queen out of a hive and you're putting her in something, typically if she's a laying queen, they'll pick up on her sense. And they'll accept her. Now, if she was sitting on a table for a week or whatever and hasn't been laying from the time she got shipped and some of that, then you run into the risk of her needing to be accepted and
that,
worked into
right,
the,
that integration.
To the colony.
Right. So then that was my first introduction into beekeeping. And then everything's going along well.
I remember you were feeding that yeah. colony as, on our advice.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it was really packed. And yeah. I had said to you, you need to back off a little bit.
Yeah, we were actually having backfill issues yeah, where...
They were backfilling into the brood. And
right. So we were actually confiscating too much real estate for the queen and at risk for swarming.
Yeah.
Which, again, was a great learning experience. I didn't know. I went like, feed? Okay, feed. I'm going to feed them. And I fed them too much. And then I started cutting back on the feed to, I think I was measuring it maybe a quart every 3 days instead of just filling up those brushy mountain troughs.
Yeah, the big gallon.
The big guys, yeah.
Yeah.
And everything worked out well. But then I lost a queen on the hive on the right. That was the hive on the left.
Yeah.
So the hive on the right... I went through, and this was a great lesson in understanding gestation and the entomology of the queen. I went through an entire supersedure, observing.
Yeah.
And thankfully, and I can't recommend this enough to our listeners, I can't recommend enough keeping a logbook, even though it might sound mundane. I write down everything that I do. And again, following your advice, I don't go in there and do anything unless I have a reason to do yeah. something. So I literally, if you look at my logbook, at the end of my last session, I'll go like, what are the things I want to do next and what am I thinking about? Then I'll do a brain dump and regurgitate everything that I did. I don't go as far as you do, and I probably should, where I think you record and video all your actions.
Quite a bit, yeah.
Yeah, which I probably should do. I'm at risk for forgetting stuff. So I write down everything. Because that
sometimes
becomes,
it's good to forget.
Yeah, yeah. That's
you
true.
You go the other direction, yeah, you're yeah. overthinking it.
Yeah. And then when I go in, I only go in with a mission, but...
What is your logbook, literally?
It's,
you use a computer-based logbook?
No,
using
it's analog, old school.
Yeah.
They're sewn notebooks.
Yeah, notebooks, okay.
Literally page after page after page. Yeah. Nothing fancy, but they're...
Interesting.
Yeah. They're sewn notebooks.
All freeform, no forms.
No, no forms.
Okay.
Yeah. But I always open it with the date, the time, the relative humidity, the wind, the temperature. And then I have a temperature, I have a wireless temperature sensor on the middle staging box
yeah.
that the sun hits, so I get the actual sun temperature as opposed okay. to the ambient temperature.
Yeah.
So I record a lot of that stuff and what the cloud condition is like and is it raining, was it raining, what's... I try to give forecasts so we kind of can recreate what the conditions were because that becomes important, for example, if you're going through supersedure and you need to know, well, did the queen have an opportunity to go out to
fly.
The DCA and
yeah.
fly, et cetera.
Yeah.
So I learned a fair bit that I didn't know for the first time about the life cycle of a queen because I was so wanting to go in and go like, there's no sign of a queen, there's no brood, there's no eggs, there's no... What's going on? It's like
what was your sense of how long it took her to get mated? Did you have a sense of that?
Yeah, I can't remember if it was 16 to 21 days, something like that.
Yeah,
I'm trying to remember.
I think a lot of people underestimate that, right? It takes 16 days to make a queen, and then it takes a period of time for her to be scurrying around the hive. Then she flies out, and then she comes back and practices. And
so it could be 30 days,
yeah,
I think.
It could be 30 days before yes. you start seeing her lay. And a lot of people get nervous, oh, my queen's not working. Whatever.
And that's when you can really screw up, because if they're trying to set up shop there, you don't want to go in and tear the house apart.
Yes.
And that's a lesson I learned.
And they're trying to get acclimated to her and other things too, right?
Yep.
And you're in there poking around.
And I was poking around
really
too much.
You really need to leave her alone.
Yeah. And then Barbara Hill came over and said, you know what? Stop. She looked at my logbook and said, leave him alone.
Yeah.
She said, you need to wait. We did a timeline, and she said, you need to wait 7 to 10 days.
Yeah.
You can't go in there, because now everything's happening. And then she said, I'm coming back in 10 days. And we rejoiced, because everything was working. There was a
That's
new
cool,
queen.
Isn't it? When you open it, and you're like, oh, good, things are settled. I'm in a good
yeah,
shape.
Yeah, yeah. You see eggs, you see larvae, you see brood, you see everything.
Yeah. So I was going to ask
you. So you lose an entire month. When everybody's talking about, oh my gosh, we're harvesting.
I remember
money.
Having this conversation with you about losing that month, and what would the impact be, and would you be able to overwinter? And
yeah, exactly. And then when you lose that month, forgetting about honey production, you start remembering from Randy Oliver in the charts that before, and this was July?
Yeah.
It was July.
It was late for you.
July going into August.
We were in the dearth.
Yeah, we were in the dearth. And you start remembering that chart when the population's going down of the bees, but the Varroa are going up, and I'm going, oh my God. So like, am I gonna do Mitaway quick strips? Am I gonna do Apivar? And then remember, the one hive on the left was healthy. The one hive on the right was so new, I didn't want to do any treatment. So I waited, and because of Mitaway quick strip, you have to have a 10-day window for the temperatures had to be perfect.
You got to have the temperatures right. I'm glad you picked that up, right?
Yeah.
Because so many people had trouble with Mitaway or Max.
Oh, yeah.
They just... You have to find that temperature range that doesn't gas the bees. And the first 2 days are the most important.
Oh, yeah. Well, what I did was I took some liberties. I refrigerated it to mitigate the vapor on the install. And I installed at night. Well, at night, probably like at 5 o'clock towards the end of the day.
Yeah, afternoon is when you're supposed to put it in.
That's, yeah. So between
that
and it being
super hot.
Right. And I figured any vapor effect will be mitigated by virtue of my having refrigerated it.
That was a great...
And I didn't know if I destroyed the efficacy of the drug by refrigerating. I had no idea. But it worked really well.
No, I don't think it... Knowing what I know about that, I've heard Tim say that, I believe.
Okay.
I think that was a tip he gave at a state meeting down at Stockton State College.
Oh, okay.
And I do remember him saying install it in the afternoon.
Okay.
I hope I'm not making that up, but I think I remember that.
So I did the Mitaway on the hive on the left that was requeened the first day, but healthy. I didn't do Mitaway on that, but then I did Apivar to both of them towards the end of the season. And never did an alcohol wash. Felt like I just didn't have the time to do the, because I felt like things were kind of volatile.
Yeah.
Never did the alcohol wash, but basically... went like, I need to treat. I just know that there's no reason that my hives aren't going to be like everyone else's. I know we're going to have a population, and I know I need to deal with them. I'm going to be doing alcohols.
I checked my hives and know that I did an alcohol wash on two of the ones that I had, and my mite levels were right at the threshold, and I'd be damned if I was going to lose my bee, so I did treat with Apivar. I gave them a short treatment in the fall, but you and I live... 10 miles apart as the crow flies.
Yep.
We didn't have a good fall last year.
No.
The goldenrod wasn't very good. Everything was dry. Did you feed?
It was really spotty. Yeah, I did. I did.
Yeah. How late did you feed?
Until late October, I think.
Yeah. Me too. I think I fed till Halloween.
Yeah. I think I went to
the first week in November.
Yeah. I went to the first week in November, then I stopped. Then,
but I knew I had enough food on my hives that feeding them any further in November wasn't going to make any sense. And they're heavy coming out of winter.
Yeah.
You had the same?
Yeah. I had the same experience. I had so much honey.
Yeah.
And I felt like I'll put fondant on as an insurance policy the first warm day I get when it's really cold. And I did that, and I replaced it a couple times. And then I came in with patties. Couple weeks ago.
Yeah. I did too.
They
eat it all already?
Yeah. Even with the honey there, and I'm not sure I understand how that works. Maybe it's less work to eat what's right there and not have to fly, or
I
heard conflicting stories.
I put a block of sugar and I put pollen. They didn't really need the block of sugar, but I figured, again, like you.
Yeah.
I'm trying to build a huge workforce because I want to do splits. I didn't split mine yet.
Yep.
But, yeah, they ate all your stuff already, right?
Yeah.
I know mine got consumed.
Yep, they did. They were pretty voracious.
I
they're those patties, the mighty, what is it called with the bee? Mega bee?
There's mega bee. There's a bunch of different ultra
bee. It's a Dayton one. It's one of the ones that Randy Oliver liked.
There's a number of
liked.
Them.
Yeah. So, in a nutshell, the first year was an incredible learning experience. And you'll probably get a totally different story if you ask my wife.
Yeah.
You know, because, like, just my moods and my emotionality and everything is, like, you could read the well-being or not of my beehives based on my mood. Because I took it so seriously.
That's what happens with beekeepers, right? If you're in a challenge, I know there's times when I go in and I come back and I'm just so frustrated and ready to
Yeah.
Yeah, it is. I'm with you. It's one of those things like, man, if I could just figure this out, it's a big puzzle, you know?
It is.
It's fun though, right?
Oh my gosh, I'm enjoying it so much.
Yeah.
And I'm generally, I have a book or two out on my nightstand and I've got the magazines out and, you know, I might agree or disagree with something and then I'll research something that I disagree with to see if I'm ready to change my mind.
Your biggest aha moment of the year? I mean, we already talked about several of them.
The biggest moment of the year for my first year last year.
As a new beekeeper, what was the thing that surprised you the most?
To successfully go through a supersedure was amazing.
Yeah.
To see that they can take care of themselves. To see that if left alone, but monitored, that they can lose a queen, but grow a queen, all within the complexity of this multi-organism. It's unbelievable.
How often do you inspect your hives now? What would you say this year you're going to do? How often will you be in them?
Yeah.
And is it more than when you started?
It'll be less than when I started, for sure. But let's talk about what I do when I inspect. Often every morning or when I come home in the afternoon, I've got a little chair. I'll sit in front of the hives and just watch them.
Yeah,
and just see who's coming, who's going, what's on their legs, if anything.
Is the pollen?
What color's the pollen? And then we'll take a walk and try to identify what it is they're eating because we've got wilderness all surrounding us where I know they're foraging. So I'll do that just to get a vibe for, like, are they doing well? Is there a lot of population? Is there not much population? Did it just rain? I sometimes put white plastic covers that are otherwise useless, those thermal, I'll put that on the ground so I can watch the dead bees, and then I'll go like, this is about right, wow, there's too many, it looks like there's too many bodies going. And then probably every week to 10 days, if I have a reason, I'll go in and look for evidence of queen ripeness.
Yes.
I'm not gonna look for a queen, those days are gone. I was doing that maniacally the first year because it was so exciting.
Yeah. Are your queens smart?
Am I queen smart?
Marked.
Oh, marked. One is, and of course the superseded one's not. And whether I'll mark her last year's blue color or not, I don't know. I'm inclined to let her be.
Yeah.
And just use my eyes to determine.
You have your notes so you know when she came about.
Oh, I know. Yeah, exactly. I can reverse engineer her birth date and all that stuff, within a day or two.
The one thing about marking your queen, though, is if they change her, you'd be none the wiser.
I would never, that's a good point. I would never know.
But
I probably
again,
should. I have one of those little capsules with the foam. I probably should. Yeah. I probably should do
come
that.
Come to one of our meetings, we'll show you how to do it. It's really simple and it's a lot of fun.
Yeah. And then the biggest thing is I've got my favorite tools. I use a tool that no one around here uses. It's a tool I had somebody send me from London. It's like a J-hook with little steps.
Uh-huh.
And instead of having to kind of mangle and lever and literally you take the end earlobes of each one and you put the tool in, if this is the end earlobe, you put the tool in underneath it and you just lift it up.
Yeah.
It's so simple and non-interventional and you're at minimal risk for squishing.
Yeah.
So I've really become fond
I've
of that tool.
I've seen those J-hook tools.
Yeah. It's pretty cool.
I don't think I have one. I'll have to go look for that.
Yeah.
You mentioned it.
I'll bring it to you. Yeah.
Let me know.
It's a really nice tool. And it's got a sharp beveled edge for scraping.
I tried a bunch of different tools.
I
buy equipment and some, I have a...
You want to evaluate
it. Well, for the podcast, I look at all this stuff, but some of the stuff I don't use regularly, but I have tried a bunch of different ones, and I've never tried one of those J tools.
Yeah.
I have a small little one.
Yeah, the little pocket guy. Yeah.
And I like that thing, but my favorite is the Easy Pry.
Okay, now that's one I haven't tried.
I really like that one.
That's one I need to try, And, I have a Dayton smoker, I think, and our neighbors have white pine, so I'm using pine needles. Yeah. And Oh, bee suit. I have a veil on a zipper jacket. I don't fully suit up. I usually duct tape my pants or throw my pant legs in my sock.
Yeah.
And I still get stung, but don't we all? I mean, if you say you don't get stung, you're probably not beekeeping.
You'll get stung.
Yeah.
Mostly in the fingers. So you go gloveless? Or
yeah.
You,
I try to go gloveless. Yeah. If I read their mood to be a little bit defensive, I'll put the gloves on, as much as I hate the feel. You really, you lose that tactile.
You do, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. So I try to go gloveless. So I'm doubling from 2 to 4. I'm doing nukes again. This time, you know Carly?
Yep.
Yep.
Yeah, Carly Ted.
I had some nice talks with him. He's expensive, or he's more expensive than anyone else. But I have 2 nukes coming from him. And I'll see what he does.
I've gotten bees from him in the past. He's got Carniolian bees.
Yeah,
I like his stuff. I've used it.
Yeah. So I was convinced that he was just a thoughtful apiarist. And
he is. He's also local. I mean, he's in Hillsborough. He's doing all this stuff. So that's pretty close.
And that was good. Because I'm trying to figure out a way to get away from, you know, we're trucking up the bees from Georgia. We're trucking up the bees from Florida. It's like, you read those reports. I mean, there's something going on. I'm not sure they've got a grip on it. I've heard some theories about getting grip on it, but a lot of the mass-produced queens trucking up from the South, there's some issues with them. Yeah. A lot of them don't make it through the year.
It's funny, though, is that I hear both sides, right?
Yeah, and the guy that came to one of our meetings... I hear both sides.
The apiarist... I don't want to mention names, so I'll stay away from that.
Yeah, yeah, fair enough.
The queen producer and the package producer that spoke at our meeting recently, you can go look on YouTube if you really want to know who it is.
Yep.
I was pretty impressed by his conversation, and I know who brought him up here and why, and I bought one of his packages last year, and it did really well.
Okay.
And I'm buying 2 more this year.
It seemed like his operation was great.
Because I'm going to put them into non-conventional hives, and I can't put nukes in them, right? I'm going to do a Ware hive this year, and I'm going to put one in my top bar.
Right. Okay.
And so I'm going to start with them. But the fact of the matter is, I have access to abundance of local queens, so somewhere along the line, I'm going to take their queens out and put my name
from
local stock. That being said, Dave Tarpey, who spoke, talked about queens and said that the commercial queens that he sampled anonymously were pretty good.
Right.
Didn't see problems with them. By all the measurements and metrics, the queens that he got performed admirably.
Right, the numbers of matings and the...
Yeah.
Right.
So from that respect, I don't know. If, you know, there's, as you said before, there's all this lore out there. People love to share their commentary. And without the evidence of Randy Oliver or somebody, what do they really got other than notions that, you know, and a lot of times, for what it's worth, there's half, I believe this, half the beekeeping community does it well and the other half doesn't. And that means half of them can say things that don't make sense, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I totally agree.
Maybe that half ratio is wrong, but it's just illustratively, there's a lot of people out there who don't know what they're talking about.
Yeah, yeah. Right? And I think that's the challenge as a beginner. Now it's getting a little bit better because as you build up a knowledge base based on scientific articles, you learn who to read and who to trust. And then you start understanding that certain people are just really strongly opinionated but have no scientific basis for what they're saying. And then you're a beekeeper when you start being able to separate the lore from, you know, evidence-based.
Well, so welcome to your second year.
Thank you.
I'm here from 2008, and I still feel like a novice at times.
I definitely feel like a novice.
You know, I've run through the trough of disillusionment, which Randy talks about, and I feel like I'm going up the other side. I've had enough exposure and information on this is that I feel like I have a good game plan. I wish you the same. You know, I hope
you
can
so
get there quickly and stay with us.
Oh, I'm having so much fun. And the organization, just a little bit of a pitch, and I know we didn't discuss this, but the chapter is like my lifeblood. Because there's so many practitioners and so many beekeepers that have been keeping for a long time. And they probably see it when I question them that I really need to know, because I'm really trying to work through an issue. And it's great to hear. And, you know, yeah, you ask 100 beekeepers a question, you'll get 150 answers, whatever. But that's okay when you learn how to assimilate what you're hearing.
That's what will happen over, when you're as far along as I am. You'll be able to fairly evaluate that based on your practical experience.
Yeah,
the more
you're
in your hives, the more you'll go, yes, I've seen that, that makes sense, or no, I don't quite agree with that, and okay, thanks for telling
me that.
But, you know, we have Bob, we have Joe, we have Stan, we have Roger, we have Barbara. And all these people who have been doing it for a period of time.
And it's been such a resource.
That's a great part of Northwest is, you know, and even the state level, you know, I get a chance to talk to people across the state being in the position I'm in, and, you know, access to Tim Schuler for everybody. What a godsend in that respect, so.
Yeah, I had a friend whose hives I'm beginning to take over for him in Hopewell, Bob Harris, who actually taught beekeeping at Princeton for years, but he travels a lot, and he lost 3 of his 4 hives last year.
Yeah.
So I said, let's get Tim to do a postmortem, because we need to know if we got foul. We need to know what's going on.
Right.
Tim came over. I spent an hour with him last Wednesday, and it was so instructional. It was amazing.
Without a doubt, going through stuff with Tim every time. You know, I've shot some videos for him and with him and worked alongside and even gone to his house and seen his operation. And yeah, every time you have a chance to work with him, there's nobody that has their hands in more bees than Tim, I think, other than, you know, obviously the commercial guys like Grant and so on. But yeah, without a doubt, that is great. So what was a... You know, I have this suggestion to you. You have Bob Harris, is his name?
Yeah, Bob Harris, yeah.
His location and your location. So if you make splits and whatever and you guys can work together, I think that's the theme of 2016 for our association.
That's what we're doing.
Is find a buddy system, right?
Yeah, there's like, of the 6 or 8 that I mentioned in our area, there's 2, possibly 3 of us that we're comfortable with each other's practices, motivation, curiosity, whatever, that we're starting to share.
That networking is so important. And having the ability to make a split and take your nuke and put it over in their yard for a period of time.
That's exactly what we're doing. We, if somebody's out of town and it's time for Apivar, I'll go treat his, he'll treat mine, whatever.
That's great.
That makes it so much better. Yeah. So that's what we're doing. Like just a little local group. Yeah.
So is there anything I didn't ask you about? about this that surprised you?
No, it's just...
We covered a lot of ground.
Yeah, it's been so much... It continues to be fun.
I have to ask you about something. A little birdie whispered to me that you have a music background.
I do.
And it's not just a fancy music, like a hobby. It's something a little deeper than that. So tell us.
Yeah, I joined the music. I'm a musician. I'm classically trained from the age of 4, before I was 5, on cello. And I'm self-taught, and then I had lessons at the same time when I was 4 on guitar. And I joined the Musicians Union when I was 13. My parents used to drive me to jobs in Philadelphia.
Yeah.
Gainful employment, where your parents would take you to all these clubs. I couldn't drink, obviously, and I, you know, but I was in
the
union.
Are you from this area?
I'm from Philadelphia, the suburbs of Philly. And then I went to college and then taught myself pedal steel guitar, which is the love of my music, and moved to Nashville and was a studio musician and a road musician for maybe 15 or so years in Nashville, touring the world with people like Willie Nelson, George Jones, Johnny Rodriguez, Waylon Jennings. I played with everybody.
Yeah.
And I did staff work for the Grand Ole Opry, did all the TV shows like Hee Haw and Midnight Special, Don Kirshner.
So if I go back and watch old Hee Haw and I find you,
And so I did a lot of that on pedal steel guitar.
I had no idea. Somebody whispered to me that you had played with all these people.
Yeah. And we're sitting in Rojos.
Yeah.
Which is Spanish for red, This all was red.
Yeah, okay.
And that's a nickname in 1973 that Willie Nelson gave me. He called me Rojo. That was red ponytail, red beard. Yeah. And then 1985, I moved back up north to be closer to my wife's parents and our parents as they aged. And I went to law school. And then I became an entertainment lawyer. And was an executive for 15 years or so at Sony Music in New York at the headquarters.
Yeah.
And I worked, I executive produced Bob Dylan. I worked with all kinds of people. And then I headed the Advanced Technology Group and did secret work in the think tank for the Japanese think tank in Tokyo. I've got 8 patents to my name in music technology. So yeah, I've been in music my whole life. I'm a musician.
And,
yeah.
So... What is this, your retirement gig here, or this coffee thing?
I don't want to retire. I love what I do. So in 2005, when I left Sony, they merged with Bertelsmann in a joint venture, and I asked to leave. I wasn't liking the music industry. It was getting what I call toxic. So I was looking for my next career, and... I have a background in organic chemistry. I love to tinker. I love industrial design. So I rebuilt that 1956 German roaster, very, very rare roaster. And we use it every day. I mean, that's a working machine.
I'll have to take a shot and put it in the in the podcast blog so that people can see. We'll shoot some candidates around here of your setup.
And I jokingly say that the reason I built Rojo's 11 years ago was so I could own a forklift. So.
Yeah.
You see the forklift sitting over there.
Yeah.
Because we're bringing in thousands of pounds of coffee every couple of weeks to roast and to send out to our accounts. So, yeah, it was my next career. I was 55 then. So I have no interest in stopping what I'm doing. I love what I do.
There's another location in Princeton, too, which I didn't know until yesterday when we chatted.
In Palmer Square, right next to the Bent Spoon
in
the historic part of Princeton across from University. We've been there almost 3 years.
Are you here like 7 days a week?
5 to 6 days a week when I'm not traveling. Like I do what's called origin trips where I'm doing coffee research or looking for new farms to play with or looking for ways to improve agricultural processes with the coffee farmers to improve the taste. I have a certified palate. I'm called a Q grader. There's a relatively small handful of us in the world that have that level of palate. So work with my palate. Yeah. So
are you a foodie too?
Big time.
Yeah.
Big time. I love working with chefs that have a good
palate.
If you
do a lot of traveling or whatever, listen to Gastropod. That's my latest podcast. It's a foodie podcast, and it's interesting. They talk about microbes of the soil, and it improves the food and things like that.
Oh, yeah.
Be right up your alley.
Yeah, yeah. That's what we do.
Yeah.
I'm always looking at soil type. The terroir that everybody talks about in wine, it has everything to do with the terroir in coffee growing.
Yeah. So this year, you're going to get some honey.
Yeah, I can't wait.
And you'll be able to figure that out.
Yeah, I can't wait. I got some equipment last year in anticipation of this, like an extractor and...
Yep.
Some stainless containers. Nice. And the question is, to what extent will the foundationless frames be strong enough to not have to crush and strain?
They'll have to figure out. That's why Roger put those dowels in so that he could spin.
Myself the same.
Yeah.
So they seem pretty strong as long as I don't spin too quickly, you know?
Yeah.
And we'll see.
I'm aligned with you, especially lately. There's been some conversation about how much Kumafos and fluvalinate's been in foundation, and I think I need to get out of the foundation business. And also Bob Gloss, who I talk to all the time on the podcast.
Yeah, Bob's way into it, isn't he? Yeah.
Bob's really into foundationless, and his hives have been doing really well. And I think I'm, you know, it's just been a matter of, I tinkered with my hives too much that I lost the stability. And last year I went back to the typical recipe that you followed and talked about. And from now on, I'll be a little more conventional, but I'm going to build more hives. And then with my excess hives, I'll start to be more treatment-free and foundationless and all that other stuff. But it's nice to get honey, and you'll appreciate that. And
I'm
maybe
excited,
you'll be bringing that back in here somewhere.
We probably have so many customers already asking me,
Are
you going to have your honey here at Rojo's? So,
Well, this has been awesome. I really appreciate it. You know what we got to do is come back a year from now and talk about year two and see how
it went. I would love that.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Kevin. Yeah.
I also will say to you that maybe you'll take me up. I love coffee. I roast mine at home.
Yeah, I know.
Complete novice, right? But maybe what we're going to do is come back and do an episode just on the coffee shop and talk about some of that stuff. Not beekeeping, and we'll make sure people know up front. And we'll come back and have a chat about that, maybe, too, because I'd love to hear about the operation.
I mean, we can have the big machine fired up, but maybe what we do is sample roast on our lab roaster and go through a cupping,
an analytical tasting,
something that I do almost every day anyway. And that's how you...
I'm game.
Yeah, good. So you're hereby officially invited to come back and do that.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah, so again, thank you for this.
You're welcome.
Hope everybody enjoyed the podcast, and I'll do a little wrap-up here afterwards, but I really appreciate you taking the time and inviting us into your place, and good luck on your beast.
Thank you.
Really enjoyed
helping you out. Appreciate it. Thank you for all your help, and thank you for everything the chapter does
to
help me as a beginner to understand.
There's so many people that help out from our organization, so all right, good.
Great.
Thank you.
Hey, everybody, this is Kevin to wrap things up. David, I could tell, is one of those unique individuals. In my father's hometown, they call him Amazing Joe because the locals were surprised at all the things he could do. He's a craftsman as a bricklayer and a mason. He can fish like nobody's business. He lives in a fishing community near the Chesapeake Bay. He builds hot rods in his spare time, and, well, he just has a lot of tricks up his sleeve. In listening to David, he surprised me even more in learning what he's done and where he's been. I have no doubt that he'll be successful in beekeeping and count myself fortunate that he happens to be in our sphere of influence. I spoke in our last episode about how the enthusiasm of new beekeepers energize all that come into contact with them, and David is a personification of what I was speaking about. I hope you enjoyed the interview, and I do intend to follow up on the notion to bring him back at the end of the year too, if not sooner. We spoke offline after the interview about a non-beekeeping coffee episode, as I'm a hobby roaster at home, and I could tell you there's nothing like coffee that is fresh roasted and ground. It really does trump anything you could buy from a grocery store for sure, and any of those Seattle chains. They're okay. And I don't mind, I stop there on occasion. And I don't want to sound like a snob, but there's just something about it that really makes fresh brewed coffee from something you roasted at home stand out. Perhaps a comparison that you can draw an analogy is packaged cookies or bread in contrast to a cookie or bread that is fresh baked just out of the oven, to paint the picture. Anyway, I've spoken to a number of interesting people lately in various beekeeping practices, and we'll be adding a handful of additional interviews into the mix. So stay tuned, and I hope that you enjoyed this. It's time to go, but before we do, we'll end with our parting thoughts. Like our beloved bees, when beekeepers go together, we accomplish great things. Thanks for listening, everyone, and be well.